They were the Fab Five of 80s New Wave, who made their mark with a unique blend of rock, funk, and futuristic pop. And the superstardom they achieved was beyond their imaginations. Duran Duran became the British masters of style, who seduced the world with glamour, groove, and good looks. Their unique musical styles made them famous, but it was also tearing them apart. As the 80s came to a close, they were left for dead. But Duran Duran dug deep and scored their biggest hit. Now, over 20 years since Duran Duran's original episode of Behind the Music aired, they're reflecting on key moments of their lives, giving new insights on the past and celebrating the present. This is Duran Duran, the story behind the music. In the spring of 2021, Duran Duran was finishing work on their 15th album, Future Past. The record marks the continued evolution and artistic innovation of Simon Le Bon, John Taylor, Roger Taylor, and Nick Rhodes.
There's plenty of scope in that for melodies.
Why don't we see?
What's always driven us to move forward is curiosity, intrigue, excitement about what's next, what can we do, how far can we push it. Why can't we do that? Let's try.
You have to keep on moving. If we'd have stopped at Rio, I don't think we'd have got very far.
Anybody that gets to do what we do for this length of time needs to justify themselves. Roger, Nick, myself, and Simon, we all can still impress each other. You know, we bring something new to it, so it's exciting.
We really believe in what we're doing. We really believe in the music we're making. We believe in Duran Duran.
Duran Duran's artistic journey began in the late 70s in Birmingham, England.
The images of the Beatles going around the world, you know, as a 4 or 5 year old kid were pretty indelible. And thinking, I like the idea of doing that, you know, now what do I have to do?
John, I met when I was about 10 years old.
We hit it off pretty much straight away.
We're both only children, we're both Geminis, we're both super creative.
We were always interested in art and cinema. We had a keen interest in photography.
We got into all sorts of things together, but we also had a shared love of music, particular music.
John and I came from a sort of glam rock, T-Rex, David Bowie, Roxy Music, Sparks. And then we went through disco. Unlike other people, we kind of liked disco, especially Chic. We also loved electronic music and punk rock, the energy of punk rock, the Sex Pistols, the Damned, Susie and the Banshees, the Clash. We had inspiration all around us.
By their late teens, John and Nick were devoted scholars of innovative sound and vision.
We'd ride home after these gigs and we'd say, well, did you like the Projections? And that opening song was cool, right? The way that they did that thing with the synth. And what was that synth?
The two friends began to learn the craft and devised an artistic mission to create their own brand of cutting-edge music and take on the world.
We wanted to take rock music onto the dance floor. We wanted the sound we made to become a sound that everybody liked.
If John and I want to make something work, if we agree, it usually happens. It's making your own opportunities. It's seizing those opportunities. People don't get lucky. People make their luck.
After a year of playing with local musicians who couldn't match their creative ambitions, John and Nick recruited drummer Roger Taylor, who was immediately struck by their intense focus and shared sensibilities.
I mean, those two were just on the same page from day one. They had this connection between them. They were like brothers. It was a huge moment in my life to find these people that A, had the same influences, B, they kind of dressed like me, and C, they were just totally committed to what we wanted to do.
Duran Duran became the house band at the Rum Runner Club in Birmingham, where they befriended club owners Paul and Michael Barrow, who started to manage the band.
For a bunch of teenage kids like ourselves, you know, they were able to give us all jobs in the club, and they brought me an amp and gave us somewhere to rehearse.
John and Roger used to collect glasses and wash up. Nick was the DJ, great DJ Nick was.
We had a goal,
and everybody did everything they could day and night in order to achieve it.
When Nick and John placed a want ad in the music trade magazine Melody Maker, it caught the eye of guitarist Andy Taylor.
You know, they had this whole scene, the rehearsal room off this club, offices above, the managers and the club. I thought, well, this is all right. I thought, do we get a tab at the bar? You know, oh, yeah, yeah.
And one of our barmaids at the Rum Runner said, oh, you should, I'll get my boyfriend to come down. And Simon walked into the kitchen one day, and that was it.
I found the Rum Runner down a little alleyway, and I said, is this where I will find Duran Duran?
As soon as I saw Simon, I thought, yeah, he's got that swagger, he's got the confidence, he's got the cockiness that it takes to be a singer.
I was a drama student since I was 5 years old, and I guess I was used to being on stage. And when I walked down that alleyway, I was on stage.
Roger, John, Andy, and Nick were immediately struck by Simon's charisma. They just hoped he had the voice to match.
I thought, please, please just let him be able to sing. As long as he can sing in tune, we can get around it, I'm sure.
Then we went into this little triangular room called the Tritech Room, and they started playing their music.
And Simon was like, oh, hang on a second, you know, and he had this, I mean, this is mythology in the Duran Duran story, had this book with lyrics in it, you know, which we were like, ooh.
Then I said, I think I can, I've got something that would work with that.
As soon as he started to sing, he was just the right tonality.
I knew as soon as he opened his mouth, it was going to work.
We had these glances around the room, seems to say, this is the guy, we've got him.
He just felt right. He was one of us.
The new bandmates began writing songs together and gigging around England, where their hard-edged dance grooves quickly grabbed the British music scene.
Roger and John wanted to be in Chic, you know, and then Andy comes from Newcastle. It's like a tougher place. He's got a bit more of this like heavy rock background. Then Nick just built this sonic architecture out of all these synths. Simon just brings these like arty, weird, abstract lyrics. So like they were this Voltron.
We had a chemistry between us. And when we started playing, something happened. A fuse caused the electricity to fire all around the room.
We all appreciated that together we were capable of achieving something great. Like, I may be really kind of different to this guy, but if I get really close to him, maybe we can really do something.
In 1980, the five members of Duran Duran each brought their different musical backgrounds to form a collective vision. And through their songs, John, Nick, Andy, Roger, and Simon became inseparable.
It was really the music that made the personalities gel.
We went everywhere together and did everything together. We were very, very close.
Duran Duran carefully designed an innovative aesthetic that went way beyond music, meticulously building their image through photography, art, hairstyle, and fashion.
I definitely loved the visual of the band, and I went to get my hair cut when I was 11, and I remember taking this picture, like, folded up from, like, some fan magazine of John Taylor, like, in my back pocket. And I, like, literally, like, reached in my back pocket. I'm like, so, this please. And I remember leaving, and my mom's like, what's wrong with you? Like, I wasn't crying, but I was, like, really upset. And I was like, he cut my hair like Nick Rhodes, and I showed him John Taylor.
By 1981, Duran Duran became the leaders of the new romantic music revolution. With the release of their self-titled debut album, they took full advantage of an exciting new record marketing tool, the music video.
It became a very, very important way that we could manifest ourselves all over the world.
It was done because our managers thought it would get us a lot of attention. They were right about that. It was an eye-opener.
Their debut reached number 3 on the UK albums chart. After a 10-month tour, they worked quickly to record a follow-up. One Saturday morning, Simon and Nick dragged themselves into the studio after a night of heavy drinking.
That morning, I don't know why I agreed to go into the studio on a Saturday.
I had a shocking hangover. I didn't really want to go into the studio at all, but I had a relatively new synthesizer at that time, and I wanted to play around with it. Simon came in, heard it, and said, "Wait a minute. Okay, do that again."
And suddenly we had something going. The rest of the band came in, and they just loved it.
Andy put, I think, probably one of the greatest rock riffs of the 1980s down. There was something about it that just sounded right.
In just under 2 hours, Duran Duran had created Hungry Like the Wolf. The band was creatively firing on all cylinders. And as the sessions progressed for their second album, Rio, Duran Duran knew they were making a masterpiece.
I don't recall there being any self-doubt with that record. It was just everything flowed.
When Rio was released in May of 1982, Duran Duran formulated a plan for a new music video.
We had this idea to make a video that was kind of based on Raiders of the Lost Ark, hence the hat.
You know, it was a quest, and it wouldn't have worked if our singer hadn't have had some experience in acting.
Duran Duran premiered Hungry Like the Wolf on MTV in February of 1983. While the fledgling network was still working to find a wider audience.
It was interesting because MTV was only in about 3 or 4 cities at that time. And we could see that the people that were seeing MTV, there was a spike in our radio play. It was going up because people were calling in to the radio station saying, "I want my Duran Duran." MTV most definitely had an effect.
As MTV's viewership grew, so did Duran Duran's fan base. The band arrived in America, where the media hyped them as the new Beatles and dubbed them the Fab Five. They soon found it wasn't safe to travel the streets alone. Adoring teenage fans pursued them everywhere.
We're really enjoying the success because this is a bunch of guys that have gone into the music business for the affirmation. We wanted people to like us.
The success that we had out of the gate and the kind of success it was, I mean, we didn't see it coming.
We get on stage and we play our songs, which a lot of them were sexual, and we'd have this wave of sexual energy sort of come towards us.
For us, the world had changed and we were these icons. Suddenly, we were rock stars.
It was sort of thrilling. We'd seen the footage of the Beatles and the Doors and the Rolling Stones, and nobody had expected to see that again. And somehow, it was us.
With their conquest of America, Duran Duran became international cover boys. They were besieged by fans seeking the ultimate autograph.
It was a babe fest backstage. For all the security, somehow the girls would get through. And it didn't hurt that they all were the supermodel type.
I definitely felt a rivalry with John for attention, for female attention. And John won that battle completely and utterly. He won it.
I mean, there was a competitiveness between the band. You almost couldn't help it. You know, when they started doing like individual t-shirts and individual poster sets, and somebody had mentioned how many I sold, how many Andy sold. And I think that they were the seeds of dissent.
We all started to get girlfriends. That changes the dynamic completely because you're not just a gang of 5 young guys running around doing stuff together. You get separated out and suddenly one of the partners will say, "I don't know, I don't think you should be doing that," or, "Why isn't there more of you in that video?"
When we started, it was a bunch of guys that would hang out and spend 24/7 together. But I think as the pressure built up, everybody kind of retreated a little bit.
It just begins to fragment. As with anything you build, the cracks start to show.
In 1983, despite an emerging divide within Duran Duran, excitement continued to follow the band on tour as their concerts became sold-out teenage scream fests.
With that much fun going on at the shows, where everybody, there were 20, 30,000 people having that much fun, you couldn't just unplug everything.
We're having fun. We are definitely having fun. I was.
I noticed that Roger wasn't feeling the same way about it as I was.
He didn't really like that kind of attention, and he didn't feel safe.
Roger Taylor's growing discomfort with the hysteria that stalked Duran Duran came to a head one night in Manchester, England.
We played a show, and the theatre was kind of on its own block, and the crowd had surrounded the entire block, and we couldn't get out. And the noise around, you could just hear these people screaming and shouting and singing and chanting. It was loud and it was intense. You could not escape from it. And I looked at Roger, and then he had this look on his face, was like, and I said to him, are you okay? He said, this is, how are we gonna get out of here? How are we gonna get out of here?
A little bit of fear crept in because it was going somewhere that you couldn't have foreseen. I didn't know we were going to be like the next Beatles, but suddenly I felt my life kind of closing in a bit.
Roger stuck it out at the time, but it was clear the band's success was turning into something they had never anticipated.
We were celebrating really what we'd achieved, and no one was there to stop us. And sometimes it would get way out of hand.
While each member of Duran Duran dealt with fame in their own way, for John Taylor, the party was getting out of control.
My drug of choice was coke. I was able to be this pin-up guy, 24 hours a day, especially after midnight. It was really useful then.
Drugs and alcohol are about numbing emotions and feelings. I think there was just so many feelings going on. The entire experience of band's career, it was just like too much. I was just waking up every morning thinking, now, have I got what I need to get myself through the day? The drugs and alcohol were kind of running me. And it wasn't about, do I want to? It was like, I have to.
Despite the toll their success was taking on the band, Duran Duran retreated to the south of France to write their highly demanded follow-up, Seven and the Ragged Tiger. Recording sessions lasted a grueling 6 months, and unlike their previous albums, the divided band was no longer seeing eye to eye artistically.
The third album was grind. It's amazing that any of us were still speaking to each other by the time we finished that album.
Andy would want to bring it in this direction. Nick would maybe want to bring it over to that direction.
Andy's also got a very forceful character. In a way, he's like me like that, in that when he decides he wants to do something, that's what he wants to do.
They were never particularly suited to each other. If they weren't in a band together, they would have never been friends.
As we started getting further and further and further apart, I think the elastic broke.
The band was forced to keep it together to support the release of Seven and the Ragged Tiger in 1984. But by the end of the tour, Andy was on the verge of quitting Duran Duran.
Andy was like, I'm not doing this again. This isn't working for me. And I didn't want to lose him.
In late 84, John and Andy decided to form The Power Station, a side project with hard-hitting, guitar-driven rock. It was a clear and intentional departure from Duran Duran.
It's like, come on, let's just go and do something where you can play as loudly as you like. There'll be lots of room for solos. They can be as long as you want them to be.
One of Andy's driving forces to make The Power Station was to get away from Nick.
The album was a hit, and John and Andy started to realize they might be able to have careers beyond the Fab Five.
It started to seem like, well, maybe this is something more than a one-off.
For Simon, Nick, and Roger, it was clear that the musical differences that once brought Duran Duran together were now tearing them apart.
Musically, we were always pulling in two different directions, and the tension between what I do and what Andy was doing was one of the great things about the dynamic in early Duran Duran records. When Andy decided he wanted to go a bit further and a bit more rock, that's just too much for me. I have no interest in that.
Nick and I were interested in something different. We wanted to be more experimental.
In the summer of 85, Simon, Nick, and Roger formed Arcadia and recorded an album with several high-profile guest stars.
Oh, what an amazing time we had. Incredible. It was a good lineup. Dave Gilmour, Sting, Grace Jones. It was an amazing lineup.
All the groove and the guitar and the heaviness seemed to go to Power Station, and then all the kind of synth and clever, weird alternativeness went to Arcadia. it kind of like took something that you really loved and like, okay, we're going to take half of it here and take half of it here. So it sounded a bit like that.
On opposite ends of the creative spectrum, Arcadia and Power Station created a schism within Duran Duran.
Of course, you get competition coming into play.
I didn't want Power Station to be any more successful.
You know, we've got to make a better album than they're making. John and Andy were doing this project here. Simon and Nick were doing this project here. And I was putting one foot in each project. And these kind of two ships were sailing apart from each other. And I was kind of in the middle of it, you know, trying to hang on to both, thinking, are we going to like each other when we get back together?
After 6 months apart, the band honored a commitment to shoot the music video for their new James Bond theme, A View to a Kill, in a true case of art imitating life, as the tensions amongst the band were practically lethal.
I remember it as being pretty toxic. There was an air of resentment. We weren't getting along at all.
Andy locked himself in his trailer. He wouldn't come out to do his filming.
We're not really playing well with each other.
I think you can see when Andy is trying to actually kill me during the video. That was about as close as you'd get to reality.
I hate that video, and I don't think anybody looks good in it. And then we just went our separate ways and didn't come together again until Philadelphia and the Live Aid.
In July of 1985, Duran Duran was given an offer they couldn't refuse when their friend Bob Geldof organized Live Aid, a global fundraising event for African famine relief that featured performances from the biggest names in music.
Yes, there was going down, but what are you going to do? Pull out of the Live Aid show because it's not quite right? No, you've just got to get on with it.
You've got to pull off a big gig here. You're going to go and play in front of, I don't know how many billion people. So you have the pressure of doing the biggest show that's ever been put on the earth.
Before Duran Duran would take the stage that evening, John and Andy insisted on performing with Power Station.
The fact that John and Andy had already been on stage with Power Station said something about the whole day.
A few hours after Power Station left the stage, Duran Duran was about to play their first show in nearly a year, in front of the entire world.
I was totally committed. I think Nick was totally committed as well. I think Roger was feeling very anxious, and I think John and Andy were thinking, oh, I'm not sure I like this as much as being on stage with Power Station.
Live Aid was a bit of a disaster. When we got on stage, we got no monitors. I couldn't even hear myself. I mean, it's quite terrifying. I was having to sort of turn around and look at Roger thinking, okay, this is being broadcast to billions of people. I cannot actually hear what I'm playing.
I remember just being more impressed with Led Zeppelin than anything we were doing.
We were woefully under-rehearsed, really.
When I watch it, I can feel that it's you know, we're not having a good time.
It was just trying to hang on to a very thin piece of string. We'd really played all our chips, put them all on the table at that point. It was the end of a relationship.
After Duran Duran's difficult performance at Live Aid, John and Andy Taylor returned to touring with Power Station, and Roger decided he was ready to take himself out of the limelight.
It was a very odd time for us, because we thought we were going to have a five-piece band back together again. But Roger had actually had enough of the music business, and he didn't want to come back.
I think he was just exhausted, quite honestly.
There's only so much attention and so many glaring lights that some people can take. And, you know, you do take on a besieged mentality.
Roger Taylor left the band and withdrew from public life.
He didn't want to have anything to do with it anymore.
I don't think a lot of people really understood what I was going through at the time. And I think people tended to, you know, label it with different things. I don't think I was emotionally prepared for the height of fame that we achieved. I didn't have the tools to deal with that. It sounds like a cliche, but it was like, I need to find the real me. Who am I? When I look back at myself in those early days, I'm like, who is that? And when I left, I just kind of found myself.
Losing Roger was a stunning blow to the band. It was time for Duran Duran to regroup. But Andy Taylor ignored requests to return to the fold.
it blows your confidence a little bit when people leave. When Roger and Andy left, I think the band kind of lost a little bit of its innocence then. And it was never going to be the same.
But by 1986, John Taylor was ready to rejoin Simon and Nick. They set aside their creative differences to try and keep Duran Duran alive.
The three of us had so bonded, we just felt we were on the right path.
We clung on to each other and to the idea of Duran Duran. We learned very much to make our egos subservient to the band.
Of course it felt very different not having two members there that we'd spent every day with for 5 years. But at the same time, it was a new adventure. And in the spirit of Duran Duran, we embrace change.
The trio entered the studio to record Duran Duran's fifth album, Notorious, with one of their biggest influences as producer, Sheik's Nile Rodgers.
When I showed up to do the album, Notorious, and there was no Andy and there was no Roger, I wasn't quite sure that it would feel like I was working with Duran. But the thing is that the spirit of Duran is sort of bigger than the individual players. And it felt really like Duran.
We've never been as funky as Notorious before or since. Nile Rodgers.
Nile's got the funk.
The more you heard what you were doing, the more you had belief in it. Nile Rodgers is the person who rescued Duran Duran.
It was this new evolution. It sounded like they'd been holed up in some very expensive New York recording studio. Like, some of those records from that era just sound like cocaine and money, and I feel like that's one of them.
When Notorious was released in November of 86, it reached number 12 on the US album charts. But as Duran Duran closed out the 80s, their follow-up albums, Big Thing and Liberty, failed to make a mark. As they entered a new decade, Duran Duran were deemed a relic of the past.
The landscape had changed. We'd been pretty successful through the 80s, and I think a lot of people thought we were synonymous with that period. And when they locked the door behind the 1980s, some people were determined that we were going to be on the other side of the door, and they were taking the key with them.
And that's kind of when you realized that that moment had passed. We weren't the anymore. We were like, oh, it's over there. Damn, you know, maybe if we paddle faster, we can catch it up. But it's hard.
In 1992, the band went to work on their seventh album, writing with guitarist Warren Cucurullo, who broadened their sound. As the sessions progressed, one track emerged as particularly promising. And Simon Le Bon channeled his emotions about a recent tragedy into the lyrics.
I wrote about the death of a very, very dear friend of mine who died tragically very, very, very young. And when he died, I dedicated a part of myself to him. I was finding it very difficult to let go of the sadness and to move into the next chapter of my life. And I had to free myself. I wanted to say goodbye. And that's why I said, but I won't cry for yesterday. There's an ordinary world that I want to live in now. And I will carry on, and I will survive. And that really was my way of burying my friend instead of trying to keep him alive in my own heart, but with sadness and loss.
Simon's tribute to his late friend connected to millions across the globe. Released as a single in December of 92, Ordinary World became the biggest hit of Duran Duran's career.
To have your biggest hit, what, 13 years after your first hit or your breakthrough, like, that just doesn't happen in music. Like, that means that you have a true place in people's hearts and you have a truly special song.
Ordinary World propelled the Wedding album to the top 10. Seemingly out of nowhere, Duran Duran had once again returned to the mainstream.
We're back, and we're in the 90s. And that, for me, was one of the most significant moments in our career.
The band continued to record and tour over the next 4 years. But in 1997, the band suffered an unexpected blow. John Taylor decided to leave Duran Duran.
It was hard because, you know, I'd been a member of this band my entire adult life since I was 17. It was almost like for once in my life, I had to invest in my personal life. It wasn't easy, but it was necessary.
John moved to Los Angeles, got married, and checked into a rehab facility to finally get his substance abuse issues in order.
Getting sober was a big one for me. Maybe the biggest. You know, it was an incredible rebirth. I mean, it was good to know, at least in the way that I understood my recovery, that it wasn't my fault. You know, that I had like a faulty brain when it came to, you know, alcohol and drugs, that it wasn't just that I was making bad choices or that I was lacking in discipline.
With John tending to his personal life, only Simon and Nick remained from the original Fab Five.
John leaving was a monumental blow.
I felt deserted when John left the group.
For the next 3 years, they carried on recording and touring, but it was becoming apparent that inspiration was fading.
I really questioned whether I wanted to carry on at that point. To me, it didn't feel like Duran Duran anymore.
I think there was a couple of options. One was to just stop or look at going all the way back to the beginning again and putting the original lineup together.
I called up John.
Nick and Simon and I had lunch.
He was ready, really excited, and he said, right, let's call Roger. He said, I'm here by the pool with Simon and Nick. We're thinking about getting the original band together again. At that point, I kind of nearly fell through the floor. So I thought, you know what, I'm going to really embrace this. So I called him back and I said, yeah, okay, I'm in. So then there was only Andy, and it was a case of finding him.
Andy had moved to the Spanish island of Ibiza. After a phone call with Roger, he was on board. The five original members of Duran Duran got together in a studio in France to see if they could recapture the old magic.
Everybody had the same dynamic. Andy and I still didn't really get on. These five people not spent any time together in a room for, what was it, 18 years or something? We had some real personality issues.
How do we relate artistically? Can we still be Duran Duran? It was really hard.
Despite the clashing in the studio, the band managed to write new material for a reunion album. But when they shopped their songs to record labels, to their surprise, there was little interest.
I think we thought that just by getting together, we'll take a Polaroid and then it'll be a blank check. And it wasn't. The industry was like, well, we don't know. I mean, what's the interest level?
The band recruited former Aerosmith manager Wendy Laister to help right the ship. Her idea? Get the boys out of the studio and back on stage.
I felt that we needed to create a demand rather than going knocking on doors. I wanted people knocking on their door. So we put shows on, say, we said, let's do something, and sold out in some crazy amount of time. I mean, so much quicker than we had even thought of.
On July 7th, 2003, Duran Duran was set to play their first show as the Fab Five in 18 years, with band tensions at an all-time high.
I remember the night before the first show, I thought, I'm going to kill somebody. The intrapersonal differences were so, you know, on fire. And I mean, I'm sure I was making people crazy as well. In my back of my head, I just thought, we've just got to get to the stage.
We could hear the crowd, the anticipation out there. It was terrifying. It was one of those moments where you had to walk through, you just had to walk through the fear.
The weight of it, it was a big deal. The crowd went absolutely bananas.
Once we're in front of the audience, it becomes so obvious that it's so much bigger than we are. It's an entirely different calculation. It's like, oh, it's me and them. It's us and them.
We managed to find our way back to the chemistry that we had. It just sent chills down the spine, you know, that moment of realizing that actually this is going to work and the world is going to love Duran Duran again.
We knew that there were areas that we would disagree, but I think we were all prepared to put those aside in order to create something special as Duran Duran.
Simon, John, Nick, Roger, and Andy continue touring for the next 2 years, playing some of their biggest shows ever. Critics began to praise the return as they released their comeback album, Astronaut. But the reunion would be short-lived for Andy Taylor, who once again bowed out in 2005.
Andy had been becoming more difficult to work with. Everybody in the band felt that.
We weren't all going in the same direction, that was clear.
I can't say I missed Andy terribly. I know how creative he is, and I would never, ever take that away from him. But personality-wise, Andy never really fit in with the rest of us.
To fill the space of their departed guitarist, Duran Duran embraced the idea of the band as a collective, with a wide range of producers and collaborators to add fresh elements to their magical sound.
It's come to be, you know, the empty chair, you know, which is like the X Factor. So it's actually a way of injecting energy and creativity into the situation.
We have found that it's good to have another person in the room. Having different people and different energy changes the way you work.
I think it's really made the four of us really kind of open our minds and our imaginations, and it's broadened our perspectives.
In 2021, Duran Duran expanded their artistic scope once again as they wrapped up work on their 15th album, Future Past. Working with producers Errol Alkin and Giorgio Moroder, while collaborating with Blur guitarist Graham Coxon and Mark Ronson.
Their influence on me is basically indelible because they were my first favorite band. I get to have this little, very personal relationship with everybody.
It's really exciting to know that you can still do it, you know, after all this time. As soon as you start hearing that sound coming back, I mean, it's a real moment. You never tire of that moment when you hear it coming back through the speakers.
We're making an album that we're all very excited about. It's cutting edge in some aspects, but it still sounds like Duran Duran, and that puts us all in a very good frame of mind.
I was an only child. I magicked into the world brothers, and I have brothers. We were all kind of equal shareholders in the dream.
There's no other band I'd want to be in.
Listen to Behind the Music on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Want more episodes? You can watch remastered, Best of the Vault, and new episodes of Behind the Music, only on Paramount+.